Open a, call the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources to order on a hearing on House Bill 2115. And we have a list of people, and I'll have our administrator give us a brief description.
House Bill 2115 is a bill that extends the period of, for which the forest products harvest taxes are imposed and establishes the rates for the extended time period. This bill applies to harvest tax reporting periods beginning on or after January 1st of 2008, and the bill does have a subsequent referral to the House Revenue Committee.
And we do have a list of people who have already signed up. If there's anyone else that needs to sign up, let us know so we can do that. But first we'll have Hal Salser, Salwasser, said that wrong, and Clark Seeley.
Good afternoon, Chair Robles, and members of the committee. I'm Clark Seeley. I'm the Associate State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you today and to testify in support of House Bill 2115. 2115 amends Chapter 321.015 to establish the forest products harvest tax rates for calendar years 2008 and 2009 in support of both the Oregon Department of Forestry's administration of the Forest Practices Act as well as support to the Oregon State University Forest Research Laboratory. And Hal and I are here today to talk about both of those elements of the tax. For the Department of Forestry, the tax is actually combined statutorily with general fund to support the Forest Practices Program in a 60-40 ratio, 60% general fund, 40% harvest tax. And that's intended to represent both the public and the private values that are represented with the administration of the Forest Practices Program. The tax rates in the bill are established on a per 1,000 board feet harvested basis, and they're calculated considering the current biennium, this current biennium's balance of the fund, the projected budget requirements for the next biennium, and then the harvest levels in the state that are projected for the next 2 years. Attachment one of my testimony shows you a historical look at harvest levels in the state over the last 25 years or so. And as you know and can see on the chart, during the 1990s, those harvest levels declined rather dramatically due to reduced funding, or excuse me, reduced harvesting on federal lands. Since, though, about 1999 or 2000, both the harvest level and the tax rates have generally stabilized at pretty much current levels, approximately 4 billion board feet in the state per year. Harvest tax rates for the Forest Practices Act are shown on, the harvest tax rates in total are shown on Attachment 2 over the past 16 years, and you can see the change of rates over time and where each of the components of the harvest tax go in terms of the recipient. The harvest tax itself is actually collected and administered by the Oregon Department of Revenue, and the tax receipts that are generated are transferred quarterly to the Department of Forestry and the other recipients. At this time today, we still have two quarters remaining in this biennium to receive collection on the revenue, and that those transfers will occur early next month and also the final one in early May. Because the rates for the next 2 years, 08 and 09, are dependent in part on our current ending balance for this biennium, and also because the rates are dependent on our budget, ultimately, this go-around, we'd suggest that rates not be inserted in the bill yet. In fact, the rates actually get proposed well along in the legislative cycle as the budgets come together, and we can consider the budget needs at that point. So the rates and the rate discussions remain fairly fluid through the course of the legislative process, but we're pleased to be with you today and start the process for the bill with you. And I'd be glad to answer any questions, either now or after Hal's testimony.
Any questions at this time? The other thing I would make note of, if your cell phone is on, you might start hearing some popping and sounds. The stuff picks up. It doesn't even have to be using it. If it's just on, it creates that problem from time to time. So I was hearing a little bit of the background noise and, as I was going on.
Blackberries do that.
Blackberries do it, too, as well. So. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee members. I'm Hal Salwasser, Director of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory and Dean of the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. I'm going to describe for you the programs of the Forest Research Laboratory, its value to Oregonians, and our need for an increase in the tax rate. We're in conversations with those who now pay the tax, and there is no agreement yet on if or how much change the rate should change. But if it were to change, I'd like you to know some of what it would do for Oregonians. Forests define much of the identity of our state. The forest cluster contributes about $13 billion and over 85,000 direct jobs to our state's annual economy. All Oregonians, urban as well as rural, enjoy clean water, wood products, fish and wildlife, scenic vistas, and myriad recreation opportunities that flow from the management and conservation of the state's abundant and diverse forest lands. That management requires cutting-edge science, highly skilled managers, and targeted know-how, and the Forest Research Lab is where most of the new forest science and technology are generated for the state. Our researchers work on nearly every aspect of forest resources: tree genetics, forest soils, tree growth, forest watersheds, water quality, forest wildlife, forest and climate, forest management, forest recreation, timber harvesting, wood products manufacturing, wood products engineering, high-tech wood-based composites, forest policy and economics, and the human dimensions of forest issues. All of these fields and more are at the heart of the mission of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory. The FRL is the forest research agency of the state and is tightly integrated with the college's teaching and extension programs. These three missions are how the college and Forest Research Lab meet our land-grant responsibilities to serve all Oregonians, both rural and urban. Oregon's forest and forest sector infrastructure are vital to sustaining the quality of life in Oregon, and they're a key to the competitive advantage for the future of the state in turbulent economic times and increasing globalization. And whether the focus is on quality of life or economic growth, FRL helps Oregon maximize that competitive advantage. The harvest tax dedicated to the Forest Research Lab is currently at 67 cents per thousand board feet, has been that since the year 2000, and it yields about $2.7 million a year to support faculty and staff salaries and support services to the full diversity of the research lab's research program. I and previous directors have used the revenues from the harvest tax, the FRL appropriation from general funds, and federal formula funds called McIntyre-Stennis to cover salaries, benefits, and services for all faculty and staff in every aspect of the research of the FRL. In addition to the FRL appropriation for the last biennium at $2.72 million and the federal funds at a little less than $700,000, these funds are all pooled, and they're allocated to faculty and staff regardless of their discipline or the focus of their work. The faculty and staff then use that base funding to allow them to compete for federal and state grants and contracts, and they actually return about $5 in grants and contracts for every dollar of appropriated state general fund money, over $13 million last year, creating a lot of jobs and helping to build the research program. The harvest tax supports about 14% of the annual research work of the research lab, the FRL appropriation about 13%. The largest budget source for our research far and away is grants and contracts at 63% of total research funding. Those are predominantly federal grants and contracts. Just a few words on some of the contributions and value that the FRL contributes, helping to grow a sustainable economy. The state is one of the leading centers for wood products manufacturing, enhancing Oregon's quality of life, whether the source of clean water and air, diverse plant and animal species, recreation, or jobs. Our forests are essential to all Oregonians, and keeping our forests healthy and productive so they can serve our present needs and also serve the needs of our children and their children is at the heart of sustainable forestry and the mission of the college and FRL. In public safety, we all want an environment that we can live and work in that is safe and healthy. Clean air for healthy living and good vistas, and the work of the FRL contributes to that. If we had some enhancements in the funding, we would we do things the same way we're doing them now? No. We've actually already started changing. Beginning in 2004, we put together some new program initiatives, and we made a decision that if we were to get increases in the harvest tax in the future, if the people who pay the tax are agreeable, that we would invest a portion of that in educating the future forestry workforce, a portion in covering forestry extension, and the bulk in targeted research on initiatives that are vitally important to the forest sector in the state, including a new initiative on forests and climate. Finally, what's needed? We need an increase in the harvest tax of around 38 cents per thousand board feet to a total of $1.05, and that combined with other revenue increases that we're working on and other changes that we are currently making to reduce expenditures would allow the college and the research lab to retain the base delivery capacity and support initial implementation of the initiatives. I'll be happy to take any questions you might have.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In the areas of research, can you elaborate on what some of those initiatives are and the issue of the biomass and because I'm new at this, the conversion of woody biomass into ethanol, is that part of this?
Yes. Yeah, the five initiatives that we've identified are, one is in planted forest productivity and value enhancement is targeted to the part of the industrial forest land managers that produce most of the industrial wood in the state. The Watershed Research Cooperative Initiative is paired watershed studies that are done cooperatively with the Department of Forestry, Department of Fish and Wildlife, private landowners, and public land management agencies to make sure that we have a sound scientific basis for the forest practice rules. The Fire Management and Post-Fire Restoration Initiative is largely focused on federal lands and developing the science that would help the federal land managers do a more effective job in managing those forests. The Biomass Energy and Bioproducts Development is largely out of our Forest Engineering and Wood Science and Engineering departments. Part of it is being able to get the biomass cheaply out of the woods into a place where it can get processed, and transportation is one of the big barriers there. And then once you get it to some place, how do you efficiently turn it into either steam-generated electricity or biofuels? The technology for the steam-generated electricity has been around for quite some time and is used to be called cogeneration at some plants that burn their mill waste to make electricity and steam to heat their kilns. Now there's at least five plants in the works in Oregon to put these new biomass energy facilities in place, ranging from 10 to, I think, maybe 20 megawatt capacity. So these biomass plants would generate enough electricity to serve the needs of the mill that they're associated with, and they would sell excess onto the grid, so they would offset some of the need to find energy from either hydropower or fossil fuels. The biofuels technology is a little less proven. Actually, the technology is laboratory ready. It's just not commercially scalable yet. But we've got faculty in the College of Agricultural Sciences and the College of Engineering and the College of Forestry all working in both of these areas. The Oregon Wood Innovation Center is the fourth initiative. That is in place and is looking at new products, new business processes, and marketing. And then the final one is to bring all our scientists together who are working on forests and climate and help build a better understanding of the role that forests can play in ameliorating climate change and the impacts that climate change is going to have on the forests of the state.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for Hal. It's good to see you.
Thank you.
I just thought it would be helpful for the committee members up here for you to explain what happens to the other part of the harvest tax with the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. And then, I mean, is that set on a percentage basis, so that's not going to change their allocation? And nobody's talked about that yet.
Chair Roland, Representative Dingfelder, the part of the harvest tax that goes to the Oregon Forest Research Institute does not have to be renewed every year, and the board of directors of the institute has the ability to adjust its rate based on how much is coming in and what their program of work costs. And I serve as an ex officio member of the board, and they've reduced the rate for the last couple of years because of the high level of harvest generated more dollars than they had anticipated needing.
Just a quick follow-up?
Yes.
So what is that rate?
I, Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder, I believe it's 89 cents per 1,000 board feet.
And one last question. So why is it that they don't have to come back for a renewal and you do? And how does that work?
Can I defer?
I don't know the history.
Well, I just wasn't aware of that dichotomy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, I'm not sure I can give you a terrific legislative history as well, but the institute was created by statute by the legislature in 1991, fundamentally in a similar vein to a commodity commission or to commodity commissions in the state. I would characterize the institute as a commodity commission plus, because of their significant investment in research and education. The original statutory creation of the institute had within it the ability or the creation of a board of directors with election and appointment of board members through time. And at the same time, that board was authorized by statute to set their own rate, so to speak, in terms of harvest tax, with a cap that was set in place in the original statute. That cap is indexed in the statute then by inflation, and in fact, the institute, of course, has never reached that cap or proposed a rate above or beyond the cap. So they have the ability to change their rate on a fiscal year basis, given their expected revenues and expenses, up to a certain amount, which is capped in statute.
Any further questions? Comments? Mr. Chair, I'd like to Seeing none, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So next we have Christina McNitt.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, which is a trade association of non-industrial or family forest landowners. And really, my purpose here was just to kind of talk about the forest products harvest tax a little bit broader, a little more broadly, in fact, than House Bill 2115, and it gets to Representative Dingfelder's question. And that is, in this bill, it's a perennial bill that always comes to the policy committee for subsequent referral to Ways and Means, because setting the rates for the two items in front of you today, the Forest Research Lab and Forest Practices Act administration, is dependent on the harvest level and on the Department of Forestry's budget. But I just wanted to educate you and let you know that there are actually four programs that are funded by the harvest tax, which are paid for by the landowners who conduct harvests. And the other two programs are that our so-called Commodity Commission, the Oregon Forest Research Institute, and we also pay 50 cents per 1,000 board feet for fire. And that fire piece is one of almost half a dozen funding mechanisms by private landowners that go into protecting fire. And you'll see as you delve into forestry funding issues that there are always relationships. And in the forest products harvest tax, that's also true. For the Forest Research Lab, you just heard from Dr. Salwasser that almost half of the funds that they get from general fund, well, I'm not saying that right, the harvest tax portion and the general fund portion for the research lab are about equivalent. And you'll also see in the administration of the forest products of the administration of the Forest Practices Act, that that's a 40-60 relationship. And in fire, there's typically a 50-50 relationship. So I just wanted to kind of share that with you. It's important to maintain those relationships as we discuss what the funding levels are going to be and as this bill moves forward to Ways and Means, which the Small Woodlands Association is supportive of doing. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Next, we have Ray Wilkerson, OFIC.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council, and I'll also be very brief and basically just echo what you just heard from the Small Woodlands Association. We support this bill also. These are two very important programs. It's important that the Forest Practices Act be adequately funded so that it can be administered and enforced the way that law intends and maintain public confidence that public values are being protected and in the course of operations on private forest land, which was the whole point of the Forest Practices Act, which we're very supportive of. And likewise with the OSU Forest Research, College of Forestry Forest Research Lab, that's always also very important. Some of the most important and most useful forest research in the world comes out of Corvallis. Dean Salwasser was too modest to remind the committee that his peers just voted, around the country just voted the OSU College of Forestry as the top forestry school in the United States, which it is in our view. So, he has some real genuine funding problems related not necessarily to the not only state level but the federal level as well, and they're serious, and we recognize that, and we want to be as helpful as we can to keep that program at the high level it deserves to be. So we support House Bill 2115. I think is the usual pattern, as you've been told twice now, is that this bill ultimately ends up in Ways and Means, and that's where the blanks get filled in based on general fund decisions. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions? One second, yes.
I do have a question, and that is your relationship with OSU and developing their agenda, their research agenda. How closely do you work with OSU in that regard?
Representative Maurer, there's an advisory committee to the Forest Research Lab, which includes public and private members, does include some representatives of the wood products industry, but like all of academia, the ability of anybody from the outside to really have much influence in what they decide to do is pretty limited. It's frustrating at times to us, but that we recognize that's just the way the system works.
Okay. Hello?
That's it. No.
Okay.
We won't go there.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ray. And Ivan Molesky from Oregon Chapter of Sierra Club.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I had a little bit of a printing problem, so I'll have to read from my computer here and provide
no
you
problem.
This in a little bit. For the record, my name is Ivan Molesky. I'm with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. Oregon Chapter Sierra Club has about 24,000 members in the state of Oregon with strong interests in forests, forest health, and water quality. And we do appreciate the opportunity to be able to present some information on House Bill 2115 today relating to forest products taxation. The taxation of timber does have the opportunity to be a significant source of revenue for the state, counties, and rural areas. Historically, taxes on timber cut in Oregon have been significantly higher than the levels currently contained within the Forest Products Harvest Tax. Beginning in about 1995, timber tax collections began to fall significantly, from well over $70 million annually to approximately $15 million in 2006. This significant falloff in dollars can be primarily attributed to the elimination of the privilege tax on trees cut from large tracts of private timberland. Unlike the Forest Products Harvest Tax, which is tied to timber cut across both public and private forests, the privilege tax was uniquely linked to timber cut from large tracts of private forest land. Since large tracts of private land are located across Oregon, high concentrations in the Coast Range, Cascade Foothills, and in checkerboard ownership across much of southern Oregon, including Douglas, Coos, Lane, and Jackson counties, these private lands do have an impact on county and local budgets, whether in regard to stresses put on county road infrastructure or with potential impacts to drinking water, such as that recently witnessed Fall Creek, Oregon, after water was muddied, linked to an upstream logging operation on Weyerhaeuser land. While federal logging levels have dropped since the late 1980s, the harvest from private lands has remained relatively steady over the last 30 years. Roughly 3.5 billion board feet of private timber was cut during 2005 compared to approximately the same amount in 1978. Currently, private timberland provides roughly 80% of the volume logged across Oregon. While federal land cut levels have been trending up since about 2001, history has proven that federal lands cannot be relied upon to provide a secure and certain revenue stream for either the timber industry or for local communities that have depended on federal timber sale receipts or county payments. As this committee discusses which level to set the forest products harvest tax at, there are several key points worth considering. First, the level of the forest products harvest tax has declined significantly since 2000. Second, the legislature in the past chose to eliminate the privilege tax on large tracts of private forest land, resulting in a significant drop-off in timber tax revenue to the state. Third, with the exception of money that ends up at the OSU College of Forestry, none of the forest products harvest tax is used to support education or supplement county budgets. The College of Forestry's connection to the forest products harvest tax has also brought some controversy, as questions over academic freedom were raised after some professors sought to delay the publication of the work of other professors and graduate students in the journal Science that contradicted the timber industry's position on logging after fire events. Fourth, on top of the forest products harvest tax being discussed today, the Oregon Forest Resources Institute has been assessing an additional tax of 89 cents per thousand board feet for the past few years to support its work. The Oregon Forest Resources Institute's purpose is to provide support for the timber industry, and by statute, the Board of OFRI is almost exclusively made up of timber industry representatives, while the only public representative to the OFRI board is not allowed to be affiliated with, quote, any organization or business known to support or promote environmental or conservation issues, unquote. To conclude, it may be worth considering potential changes to the taxation of timber in Oregon. Whether bringing back the privilege tax, setting forest products harvest tax rates at a level significantly higher than they are now, or shifting funding from the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, these could all create additional revenue streams to help counties or local communities in a way that does not depend as much on the federal government or the ever-changing management of federal lands. Thanks for your time today and your consideration.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none? Thank you. That is the list of speakers on this bill. Is there anyone here that would like to speak who didn't get their name on the list? Okay, seeing none, we will close our hearing on House Bill 2115. And we'll open a hearing on House Bill 2293. So our first panel would be Peter Doherty and James Cuthcart.
We'll have a short description.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2293 amends the existing statutes related to the Forest Resource Program Trust. The bill would establish a voluntary cost share program, a voluntary environmental services program, and a voluntary loan program to further the purposes of the trust. It also authorizes the state forester to market, register, transfer, and sell credits for environmental services attributable to lands in the trust. The bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and the Revenue Office has already issued a no revenue impact statement.
Thank you.
Yes. Chair Roveland, members of the committee, my name is Dr. James Cathcart, and I'm here with Dr. Peter Doherty, and we're both with the Private Forest Program of the Oregon Department of Forestry here in Salem. And it's just great to have the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2293. I'd like to start out with just a brief background. The bill relates to the Forest Resource Trust statutes. These were created in 1993 by the Oregon State Legislature, and the first program that was implemented under these statutes was the Stand Establishment Program adopted by rule by the Board of Forestry in 1995. The assumption or hypothesis being tested by this particular program at the time was that a business investment model would be a more attractive model for providing financial and technical assistance to private family forest landowners. And the traditional methods of providing that financial technical assistance at the time were cost share mechanisms. Some viewed those as like a subsidy mechanism, as well as a direct tax credit mechanism. So the Forest Resource Trust Dam Establishment Program really was developed to kind of test that a business partnership and investment model would be more attractive to family forest landowners in terms of receiving this type of assistance. And this assistance goes to help them to meet their objectives by creating new forests on their lands, as well as the statutes had a vision beyond that, as well as helping them meet their objectives in terms of improved forest management for timber production, wildlife, water quality, and other environmental purposes on their lands. So the structure of this investment model had many features, and there were kind of options, and they came into play depending on how the landowners behaved with respect to timber harvest. There was a loan feature, there was a revenue sharing feature in kind of a venture capital arrangement, or there was kind of a grant a feature to this investment model. And the financial interests of the state were secured by a lien on the forest products that were created in these new forests. And the whole arrangement was executed through a long-term contract that actually are declared by statute as covenants that run with the land. And so these agreements not only were decisions made by the current family forest landowner, but it also bound successive forest landowners. And so that was in 1995. So here we are in 2007, and we've concluded that this business investment model did not work, kind of flopped. The reason for that is that the whole arrangement was too complex to really for our field foresters to market and sell, lengthy sign-up periods, too complex for landowners to understand. I think one of the things that we've learned is that a lot of landowners don't want to do business with the state of Oregon and would prefer not to, especially in a long-term arrangement. The administrative costs were high. And the other thing that we didn't recognize is that these type of arrangements do put the state in a position of sharing the asset management of these family forest lands. And so the administrative costs, oversight long-term of these contracts were more work than we've experienced with these other cost-share or tax credit-type delivery mechanisms. So over this time period, we've only enrolled actively right now. We only have 840 acres enrolled in the stand establishment program on 28 projects or 28 landowners. And that's just not good performance at all. There was some silver linings that came out of this idea, though. The first thing that we identified that we really welcomed was the types of landowners that were interested in this kind of model were new constituents to us. They kind of reached beyond some of our kind of core constituency and family forest landowners, and we've discovered that there's other family forest landowners that take a little, maybe a different view of their forests and not intimidated by these kind of arrangements, and the arrangements actually quite fit their needs very well. And so we do generate interest, and we do have participation in this model. The other thing was is that the model was very successful in securing funding for the Forest Resource Trust from a private source. In 1999, we received $1.5 million from the Klamath Cogeneration Project, a natural gas-fired electrical as well as steam power plant. And the reason why they provided those funds was to meet their site certificate requirements in offsetting a certain percentage of their carbon dioxide emissions from that plant. And the reason why the trust, a stand establishment program was picked was one of these new forests are created by these funds, and so they're new sources of carbon sequestration and storage that would not otherwise have occurred had not these funds been made available, as well as all those contractual structural requirements I mentioned in the business investment model that proved to be difficult for landowners to swallow, gave the carbon mitigation funder all the security they wanted that these funds would go to the purpose that they were intended to go for. And so we're in a little bit of a paradox with the Klamath Cogeneration Project because we're not meeting their performance expectations because the program really isn't that palatable to landowners. As a result, and these issues were raised by the Oregon Department of Energy regarding performance and signups in the Forest Resource Trust Stand Establishment Program. So in 2006, the Forest Resource Trust Advisory Committee was reconvened to kind of address deficiencies in the current Forest Resource Trust program. This committee is a standing committee to the Oregon Board of Forestry. It's authorized in the 1993 statutes. And the committee kind of took on two tasks. One was to make recommendations to the Oregon Board of Forestry regarding some administrative rule changes that the board could make to simplify the structure of the stand establishment program. But they also looked beyond that, way beyond that. They saw that the purpose of the Forest Resource Trust is broader than just stand establishment, and it's broader than just testing out a business investment model. It's really provides an umbrella for the state of Oregon to provide financial and technical assistance to family forest landowners. The stand establishment, the business investment model, just being the first part of that. And so the advisory committee developed a legislative concept for consideration by the board, and the board moved that with the recommendation that this be part of the governor's pre-filed bills, and we have House Bill 2293 as it sits before us. So that kind of concludes kind of just kind of the background and how we got to where we are today. I do want to mention that since the drafting of this bill, there have been some issues of scope and wording that have been raised by our partners. And so we come here today in recognition that we need to do some more work on this particular bill to work out those issues, and we welcome that kind of participation and that kind of review. One clarification I just would like to make right off the bat is that the bill uses the term qualified non-federal landowners, and the intent and the committee's intent in using that term really was to point to private forest landowners and other local government landowners, county forest lands or lands owned by metro regional government or other regional governments. There was no intent that that language would include state-owned forest lands, and there's no intent of this bill to inform or relate to policy discussions regarding state-owned forest lands. And so we recommend that that language be changed from other qualified non-federal landowners to other qualified private and local government landowners to just be very clear about that. I'd like to refer to you to, you should have got a series of handouts in addition to my written testimony, and I'd like to flip to the last page first, and there's a little schematic there, and I'm going to kind of use this to kind of talk about what the bill does. Essentially, on the left-hand side of this program, you'll see an arrow that kind of comes out of the top, and it points to what's called the Simple Loan Program. And what the bill does is really generalize the current stand establishment program and takes advantage of the new structure that the Board of Forestry adopted earlier this month, that those rule recommendations were adopted by the board earlier this month. And we can apply that loan structure to a suite of forest practices more than just stand establishment. And I think the reason why the committee, even though it's failed performance record, kept the loan program structure in the statute is that we reach a broader range of family forest landowners and we have more tools at our option, at our disposal. And so they didn't want to replace the simple loan program with another structure. They just wanted to add to it. And what the bill does, and that structure that it does add, is in that middle arrow that's just pointing straight down, where we call the cost share program. And that is a proven model of acceptance by family forest landowners. And we want to get back to using that model. We want to have the flexibility to channel Forest Resource Trust funds through that cost-share mechanism. And I just want to, the first four graphs in this handout, I just want to kind of just kind of give some background and support the point that cost-share is the way to go. On page one of the handout, in the first diagram, you look at forestry incentive program accomplishments from 1992 to 1995. And you'll see the acres involved. And back in the day, as some people like to say, the old agriculture conservation program and the forestry incentives program, ACP and FIP, I mean, that's what landowners liked. That's what worked. I hear it all the time. Why did we move away from that? It wasn't broken. The SIP program, the Stewardship Incentive Program, was very similar to the Forestry Incentive Program developed through the USDA Department of Agriculture Forest Service, and it really just had more an integrated resource approach for financial and technical assistance. It's really the habitat restoration, other values, other management purposes of forest lands. The Stewardship Incentive Program provide those funds for. All three of those programs, ACP, FIP, and SIP, are gone. They have been recreated or replaced by a program called the Forest Land Enhancement Program. You'll see that. If you have good eyesight, you'll see that in the second diagram on that page. The point is that program has not been funded very well by the federal government. We have not been receiving those cost-share dollars. So the second diagram, this shows what's happening with forestry assistance programs from 2002 to 2005. Again, this kind of is not liked by landowners, but what you'll see the trend there is that we have less dollars and we have more programs and more complexity for the landowners. Fortunately, in the Department of Forestry, we run all our cost share programs, regardless of acronym, through the same delivery mechanism. It looks the same to the landowner. It's the same application, it's the same forester, and we kind of navigate the funding sources to the application, so it looks like the same to them. The point of these two diagrams is that you'll see the Forest Resource Trust accomplishments don't add up to much relative to these other programs. So we have active participation in cost-share programs when the funding is available, and we have declining funding coming from the federal government. And so what we would like to do with the Forest Resource Trust under House Bill 2293 is reestablish that cost-share mechanism under state authorization so we can get back to the business of just providing efficient cost-share to family forest landowners. On the second page of that handout, you just see another graph that just shows how the precipitation and loss of federal cost-share dollars from all sources over time. And the last diagram on that page is just a schematic where in the tails, you know, you have tax credit and cost share really taking up maybe 80% to 90% of the need of financial technical assistance, and the Forest Resource Trust Simplified Loan Program is what that really should say, just kind of grabbing on to an additional clientele beyond that. So with respect to the voluntary cost share program, it's just getting back to the basics. It's just giving us that flexibility to take the funds that we have authorized in the trust and deliver it to landowners through that proven model using our existing infrastructure, really not doing anything new. The second part of House Bill, I should say the second group of parts of House Bill 2293, relate to the third leg on your diagram or arrow that points to the right in what we call environmental services. And I just want to explain a little bit what I mean by an environmental service. And essentially, we all know that forest lands provide a suite of benefits to the state of Oregon, economic benefits, social benefits, environmental benefits. Some of those benefits we pay for down at Home Depot, and we buy lumber and buy commodities, and forests produce those. other benefits are what's called non-monetary benefits, but they still provide a benefit, and those are the public benefits. That might be fish and wildlife habitat. That might be clean water. That might be carbon sequestration in stores. It might be soil conservation. And so what these environmental services in the sections of House Bill 2293 talk about or relate to is that as we move forward, these services now are starting to take some monetary value to particular sectors of the economy. And it's it's this area of mitigation and mitigating our environmental footprint from our activities. And so one that we've all been reading about and has been getting a lot of publicity is offsetting carbon dioxide emissions and mitigating our footprint from using fossil fuel sources of energy. And our money with the Klamath Cogeneration Project, we're illustrating how that mitigation can work through forests. But this is also being looked at in terms of water quality trading schemes, in terms of maybe mitigation banking for wetlands. And people would like to see this maybe developed for important fish and wildlife habitats. And the idea is that those landowners who are providing these benefits receive payments for for those benefits based on the quantity and the quality of those benefits that they're providing. So that's what I mean by an environmental service. And an environmental service credit is just a measured amount of those benefits in some unit. So House Bill 2263 innovatively is looking at how can we move forward on this idea for forest landowners. And there's two sections in the bill. One is Section 6. And Section 6 simply gives the state forester the authorities to participate in the markets as once they're developed. So if markets develop and there's a value for environmental services and people are willing to trade and pay for those, House Bill 2293 gives the state forester under Section 6 the authorities to serve as a supplier or aggregator of those environmental benefits based on those lands that are enrolled in the Forest Resource Trust. And those authorities would occur on all three of those arrows in your diagram on the last page on page 3. And I just want to talk about that just a little bit. On the left arrow, when you're pointing down to the simple loan program, the pricing, and I use that term loosely, the valuation of the environmental services is simply based on the cost of the project activity that's used to create the service. So let's just use the forest. We create a new forest. It stores so much carbon over time. There's a cost associated with storing that, with creating that forest. The value of the environmental service is simply the quantity of the benefit divided by the cost of the project. It's not a market. It's not a pricing. It's just trading cost of the project for so much benefit that comes from the project. And so what you have on the left side of that diagram is really what happens when we're financing 100% of the project costs and we're trading that 100% of the cost for these environmental benefits. And the state forester has authorities to do that with respect to carbon dioxide emission offsets. House Bill 2293 is just expanding those authorities to any environmental services that could flow. If you go to the cost share program, then things are a little bit differently. Under the cost share program, the landowner and the state are sharing in that investment by sharing the cost. So the government's portion of the cost is lower. And the bill doesn't prescribe this, so I'm just kind of prognosticating in terms of how things could be implemented by rule. But let's now look at more of a valuation model where a value of environmental service is created by its scarcity. And by scarcity, if you've gone to Costco recently or Ross or whatever, all stores in the Salem metropolitan area, and you try to buy oranges today, you run into this issue of scarcity because they're hugely much more expensive than they were 6 weeks ago because supply has been hammered in California due to these weather events. Well, with environmental services markets, we need to create the scarcity and start looking at these values, determining a value independent. And the mechanism for creating that scarcity is different, though, than for lumber and these commodities. And a lot of times it usually takes a regulatory action or some sort of government action to create the scarcity, so like a cap and trade and carbon offsets, and an allocation of those offsets all of a sudden creates scarcities for those offsets, and then the value can be determined through a market mechanism. Well, what House Bill 2293 is envisioning is those kind of markets developing, and so we would say the value of carbon would be so much per unit, and yes, we would be covering the portion of the cost, but that cost per unit of environmental benefit may not be enough to cover its true value, in which case then we would have to pay, make an environmental service payment, a direct payment to the landowner to fully pay for the value of that service. And then as we go over far to the right, then on the environmental services program idea, there is no government investment in the activity that gives rise to environmental service. Landowners are just making those investments on their own. They're creating these environmental services, and then they are being sold in markets. And that's what Section 3 of the bill kind of looks at is and asks the question, and it really hasn't been that developed, you know, what is the role of the Board of Forestry and the Department of Forestry in demonstrating or facilitating this kind of market development? And so it sets some priorities that we would like to see that these markets develop towards. And those, one of those priorities is, you know, we just adopted what's called the Oregon Conservation Strategy that was developed through a lot of collaborative involvement by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. It sets some priorities for conservation. We also would like to give priorities to landowner cooperatives that are trying to work together on aggregating. So we're you know, we don't want to duplicate efforts. We want to facilitate efforts. And we also want to give priorities to family forest lands and the suite of values that they produce, economic, social, environmental. That's what we mean by sustainable management. So that's kind of in a nutshell. Well, maybe a walnut shell, a kind of an overview of House Bill 2293. And in closing, you know, we, the department, would like to seek the opportunity to work further with our interested parties in refining these provisions of House Bill 2293 and perhaps bring back bill amendments for further consideration by the committee. So that concludes my prepared testimony. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Any questions at this time?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay.
Mr. Chair, for a moment, I thought I was in our special land use committee on fairness, where we're talking about valuation and compensation for an individual providing a social value. But actually, you know, in all seriousness, I do think that as you develop this model, I mean, it's happening in other places around the world, I know already, but as you develop this model, it is important to keep in mind what's happening in the Measure 37 world, because on an ongoing basis, especially in forest practices, there are values being furnished by the timber industry, and there's a law now on the books that talks about compensation for those kinds of things. So the more we are completely serious as a society about figuring out how to place a dollar value on those activities and ideally finding free market ways to do it so it's not the taxpayers exclusively, I think the better. So I guess my question is more of a comment that please continue working on this and be available to the other work we're doing in this regard.
Yeah. Chair Roblin, Representative, members of the committee, I agree heartily. We really look forward to this opportunity. And some of these efforts that are going on, one that I want to mention is the ecosystem marketplace and some of the work being developed by the Willamette Partnership. And we're just starting to learn about these efforts. And there's a lot of exciting opportunity to address the issues that you raise.
Other questions? Seeing none. Thank you. Did you have anything to add?
Nothing to add.
Okay. Thank you very much. Christina McNett. And guest.
Good afternoon again, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And with me is Mike Godern. He's the executive director of the Small Woodlands Association. Representative Klam, you hit the nail on the head, and that's kind of why I just wanted to say a few words on House Bill 2293. First of all, we see it as a laudable first attempt by the Department of Forestry to recognize and improve some existing programs and their respective delivery systems, and then a first cut at establishing a new statutory framework that has the potential to financially recognize some of the assets that we've all been talking about. These multiple contributions to public values are produced through good stewardship, and they include the provision of clean air and water, pollination of crops, mitigation of environmental hazards, control of pests and disease, sequestration of carbon and reduction of carbon dioxide emissions, providing fish and wildlife habitat. It sounds familiar to the Measure 37 discussions. Exactly. Those of us in the business of growing trees often refer to a concept called a social contract, and that is that landowners have a right to practice forestry as long as they're environmentally responsible. And then the public has a duty to support and encourage incentives and other non-regulatory measures that recognize those management costs to the landowner. Non-industrial private forest lands, the family forest lands, represent almost 40% of the privately held timberland in the state of Oregon. Surprisingly, it's only about 16% of the harvest, but we are a significant factor on the land, and we'd like to keep these landowners in the business of forestry. So with that, I think House Bill 2293, while it's far from a finished product, starts with the right ideas in mind, and we're committed to work with the department to bring forward some amendments and a better bill.
Okay. Any questions? Yes.
Yeah, I'd just like to add, for the record, my name is Mike Godern, as Christina said. Thank you very much, for Chair and committee members, for allowing me to speak. My background has been in forestry and global forest trade, and Representative Klam, you did bring up a very important point with the idea of keeping an eye on what others are doing. And whilst there are folks going down the cap and trade route, I've been in contact with a number of folks in Europe where I used to work who are looking at more voluntary approaches, especially in the Western Hemisphere, that are non-Kyoto based. So as we look at both land use and forestry in the long run, to keep an eye on where other markets are going, we really need to keep an eye on what others are doing, because if we could find ourselves in an arena where we set a baseline so high that we can't trade on a global scale for the carbon that we and other environmental services that we offer. So I would just bring that point to the committee that these emerging markets have two basic ways of going. One is the regulatory route, and the other is a more voluntary based, where the good corporate citizens that you've seen with this carbon effort so far have put their money where their mouths are, and our woodland owners put our money where our mouth is and continue to do the right thing for the land, which is really where a lot of our members want to go. They want to do the right thing, continue to remain on the land, and pass on a viable asset to the next generation who are market-based as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative, yes. Mr. Chair, I might note that I'm doing a good job representing, because one of my constituents here agrees with my philosophy.
There you go.
Only have 59,999 more to please.
There you go. Next we have Justin Martin, Gina LaRocco, and Cheryl, I'll say, Human?
Human.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of Defenders of Wildlife. I'm very pleased to have with me today Gina LaRocco, who's a conservation program associate, and Cheryl Human, who is our senior conservation incentives specialist. We are here in support of House Bill 2293 with a few modifications, and will briefly outline those for you this afternoon. As you know, Defenders of Wildlife recognize the importance of assisting private landowners who conserve fish and wildlife habitat along with water quality, and have invested considerable resources in the improvement of Oregon's landowner incentives programs. Sarah Vickerman, who is our director in the Northwest office, serves on the advisory committee to the Oregon Forest Resource Trust and has been very involved in the development of this bill. The reasons why we support most of the elements in this bill are, one, it takes an important step in introducing the notion of paying landowners for providing ecosystem services. Two, it links payment to the wildlife, to the comprehensive wildlife conservation strategy developed by ODF&W in consultation with other agencies and the private sector. Three, it sets up cost share and loan programs for private landowners. And four, acknowledges the importance of managing private forest land to conserve water quality, fish, and wildlife habitat. However, there are a number of details in the bill which need to be addressed, and Gina will share those with you now.
Good afternoon. Again, my name is Gina LaRocco, and I'm a conservation program associate with Defenders of Wildlife. And as Justin said, we support House Bill 2293 with modifications, and I just want to make 6 points that we have with regard to the bill. The first one is we'd like to see the term ecosystem services used rather than environmental services used. We've been working on this issue for a while, and that's sort of the term of art in the field, and the more we keep this consistent, the better. The second point is that the bill does not clearly indicate what ecosystem services are to be provided and at what level for landowners to qualify for payments. And since some services are already provided due to existing regulations, we believe that additional services need to be quantified somehow in order to qualify for payments in a manner that ensures the public is receiving additional benefits. Our third point is that there's no funding attached to the bill, and without funding, it's hard to see that the purposes of the bill will be accomplished. So we feel that the general fund is the most appropriate source given the broad public benefits that are addressed by the bill. Our fourth point is that, and Jim Cathcart had brought this up, the bill refers to qualified non-federal landowners, and we think that this is a vague term. And we feel that the primary recipients of the benefits under these programs should be non-industrial private landowners who provide the ecological benefits over and above what the law requires and that are consistent with Oregon's comprehensive wildlife conservation strategy. Our fifth point is that the wording in the bill seems to suggest that the Department of Forestry intends to become a broker of ecosystem services for forest landowners. And we feel that if each agency approaches it this way, it could result in increased complexity and could create confusion and might discourage landowners from participating in ecosystem service markets. And our final point is if a work group is formed, Defenders of Wildlife would like to state that they'd welcome the opportunity to participate on it. And those are our comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah. Are there any questions here? Representative Thomas?
Just a comment. This seems to be, I mean, this is a big deal. I mean, this is not a simple little project that obviously we're going to accomplish in the next 30 days or whatever. And it just seems to me that particularly point number five, I think, where you is, I have no idea what it would look like, but I guess I have questions about the government becoming a broker of something like this, and I don't know where you go with it, but it just, the more I hear, the more interesting this is. So I appreciate all this information.
And I don't know actually if you have comments, but to that point, I think that part of what you're seeing in Measure 37 or government attempting to be a broker and valuing and compensating for services essentially provided by someone who had the land before the rules came into effect, and it can be pretty difficult to get it sorted out in the beginning, at least. I mean, you know, maybe later the system would be perfected of doing it, but it is, seems tricky. And there are places, I think, as the director said, where the markets in other countries, markets are sort of figuring it out. And I know that is a great leap of faith for people from the environmental community, especially to believe that that there's a sort of natural capitalism at work that can be put in place, but it's worth studying as this evolves.
Not too many questions, but good comments. Well, thank you very much. And I do believe, having heard this from each of the groups, that we do need to get a work group going to try to come up with some stuff. So I guess what I would ask, I guess it would be Dr. James Cathcart. Would you like to be in charge of putting those people together? And we know at least a few groups that would like to be on that, including the small landowners and this group here. Others that would like to be interested can get a hold of you. Would that work for you?
That would work fine.
Okay. We would appreciate that, and we will leave this, well, close this hearing in a moment, and then we'll have this work group working, and you'll get back to us as you work towards some other opportunities to come back and talk to us.
Correct.
Okay. Then we will close this hearing on House Bill 2293, and thank you all for your participation.
Thank you. Do you know where he is now?
We're going to have a short pause before we go to the work sessions to make sure that all of our committee is here. They're off doing some other committee stuff, and we need to have them here for the meeting. So it'll just be a short one. Open a work session on House Bill 2287, and we will first hear shortly from our administrator.
House Bill 2287 is the bill that was heard last week that adds commercial flower seed to the existing law regulating the labeling, purity, and marketing of seed. You should have in front of you a -1 amendment, and this amendment would take care of the issue that was raised by Department of Ag by deleting the effective date that's in the bill so that this bill would then take effect January 1st of 2008. There is also a statement from the fiscal office indicating a minimal expenditure impact, no revenue impact, and there is a no subsequent referral on this bill.
I'll make a motion. Mr. Chair,
I would love to accept a motion.
Okay, I'll make a motion, Mr. Chair, that we move -1 amendments to House Bill 2287.
Representative Smith moves LC1 amendments dated 129 to House Bill 2287. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none. I guess I can do this actually by just consent. Well, I'll do it this way. We'll take a vote. Any disagreement with these amendments? Do I hear any discussion? Okay. Then we will
Move the dash ones.
Move the dash ones.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2287 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith has moved House Bill 2287 with dash one amendments to the floor. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion. With a good pass recommendation. Must have been an awfully good hearing that you ran last time.
That helped.
Very good.
He's a champ.
Okay, that's good. So, now we need to take a vote. Okay. So, there is a motion on the floor. I guess we'll do a roll call vote.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Mao?
Aye.
Representative
Smith? Aye.
Representative
Bowman? Excuse?
Representative
Clinton? Aye.
Chair
Wilson? Aye.
Motion carries. LC1. Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion that we put it on the consent calendar.
There is a motion from Representative Smith to move this to the consent calendar. Do I hear any discussion?
Unless somebody wants to carry it.
Unless somebody wants to carry it. We need a roll call for that.
No, we were advised that we need a roll call.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we will have a roll call on.
Should have put that in my original motion.
That's okay.
Oh, that's okay.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Mallard?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Boquist? Excuse. Representative Clinton?
Aye.
Representative
Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Chair Rosen?
Aye. So we will have this placed on the consent calendar. And we'll move on to our next one. So we'll close that work session on House Bill 2287 and open a work session on 2289. I'll have a short description.
House Bill 2289 authorizes the Department of Agriculture to adopt rules establishing maximum permissible amounts of noxious weed feed and wild bird feed. There are no amendments proposed. Again, a minimal expenditure impact reported from the fiscal office and no subsequent referrals.
Do you want this on the consent calendar?
I think we should.
Okay. Representative Robin, Mr. Chair, make a motion.
I'd like to make a motion that we move House Bill 2289 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and place it on the consent calendar.
Thank you. Representative Smith has moved House Bill 2289 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and to be placed on the consent calendar. Do we have any discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered, and I'm trying to remember now if this was the bill. It was the bill before, actually, where the gentleman from, I believe the Silverton area, talked about kind of how it worked with labeling in his particular industry. And I know there was going to be some discussion maybe, and Lisa maybe knows if somebody, if that got resolved or not, just out of curiosity.
Well, I will ask the question, Lisa. Come on up.
For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. It was the previous bill that there was a question around the labeling of flower seed in one-pound packages, and if the components of that were 5% or less, did they have to be aggregated or could they be labeled as separate components? The law currently allows for them to be labeled as separate components, which addressed the issue that was at hand.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, please. I don't know how you undo a consent calendar and a...
Equalization first.
Okay. Any further discussion on this bill?
Sorry, Mr. Principal. I mean, Mr. Chair.
This is okay. No problem. Seeing none, that was good of you to remember that. We'll have a roll call vote on House Bill 2289.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Boquist. Excuse. Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Rosen.
Aye. House Bill 2289 has passed and will be moved to the consent agenda. So, We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2289 and open a hearing on a work session on House Bill 2292.
House Bill 2292 is a bill that was heard last week that would eliminate sunset authority on Department of Ag's authority to review plans and projects recommended by a commodity commission for promotion, advertising, and research for public dissemination. It also eliminates other sunsets on requirements that commodity commissions have a public member, and the exception allowing the Oregon Grains Commission and Alfalfa Seed Commission to offer refunds in lieu of having a public member. Then there are some additional provisions that also put into place permanently provisions that were adopted in 2003. This bill has no subsequent referral. No amendments are proposed. There was a fiscal statement issued that you should have in front of you. It concludes that if enacted, the bill would maintain current operational practices and services with no fiscal impact to the department.
Mr.
Chair, I'll move House Bill 2292 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Do we want this one to go to consent or not?
It's up to you, Mr. Chair. But this one might be.
Yeah, let's leave this one.
Okay.
Okay. So, Representative Smith moves House Bill 2292 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, and I have no idea if I have to do this, but I just wanted to state a potential maybe conflict of interest, because through our pair, through our orchard, we're members of some of the commissions. One, I think, is going to be abolished, actually, at some point, the Bartlett, but the Pair Bureau. We were not party to any of these lawsuits challenging it. We always pay our little chunk happily, but we do pay them, and we're still going to pay them, from what I understand, but I thought I would just get it on the record just in case.
That's good.
Thank you, sir.
Any other discussions? Seeing none, we'll do a roll call vote.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Oakley. Representative Flynn.
Aye.
Representative Dinkelman.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Chair Roland.
Aye. So House Bill 2292 has passed, and we need to assign a carrier.
Okay.
Sure. Then we will assign Representative Smith as the carrier.
Thank you.
Any other business? Seeing no other business, we will adjourn the Committee on Ag and Natural Resources.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.